I'll confess that I'm quite a fan of Pakistani English writer Kamala Shamsie. It's not easy to pigeonhole her writing. Her book, A God in Every Stone, made me rethink what I knew about the First World War, in a story that travelled across archaeological sites and into the lives of characters devastated by history. It told the story of the many Indian soldiers who were part of the British Commonwealth forces in that war. There's a different sort of war in the background of her latest novel. Homefire made it to the Man Booker Literary Award long list, even before it was published. She spoke to me recently from London. Kamala Shamsie, so nice to talk to you again.
And to you, Kate.
Now, your novels take place in various places and times, but your last novel, A God in Every Stone, took us into the past with such complexity. I really enjoyed it. So I was disappointed at first to find this one was set in contemporary England and America. So why now? What was it you wanted to take on in this novel?
Well, you know, it's not necessarily the way novels come to me that I want to take on something. Usually it'll be a thought or image in my head that gets lodged and doesn't go away. And so whatever time period or place it's set in, I seem to need to follow it. This one was slightly different in as much as there's someone who runs a theatre in London, a man called Jitendra Verma, who said to me, I like your novels, I really like your dialogue. I would like you to do a play for me, for my theatre. And he said, why don't you do an adaptation of one of the Greeks, say something like Antigone? And I sort of went away and reread Antigone and I thought, I don't know how to write a play, but I have an idea for how this will work as a novel. And I think part of it was to do with the fact that I had quite recently become a British citizen, and there were various things that had been sitting sort of, you know, in my gut or in the back of my brain around being British, around different kinds of citizenship laws, around what it is to be British Muslim. And somehow Antigone from all those centuries ago just led me straight into a story about all those things.
And I guess when I asked you about what you were taking on, that was a deliberate thing, because although it doesn't, you're not proselytizing, but it does feel like there are big issues that you have grappled with within this intimate family story.
Yes, I mean, I do tend to like using the interplay of the really tiny, intimate, familiar setup, but to show how it is also being affected by and possibly affecting sort of much larger story that's going on. And I suppose it's just partly my understanding of the world, that the structures of power we live in affect everything, whether it's the relationship of women and men, whether it's the relationship of people of different ethnicities or class or, you know, different structures of power, that's never entirely separate from these very small, tiny, intimate moments either.
Well, like those moments when you're packing a suitcase, deciding to get on a plane, as this young woman, Isma, is, what's she leaving behind at the beginning of the story?
So at the beginning of a novel, Isma is both leaving behind and rushing towards. She's leaving behind most concretely and explicitly her younger sister, who she's pretty much raised. Isma was a very young woman. She was about 21 when her mother died. The father had never really been in their lives at all. And there were these 12-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, who she had to raise. So she had to sort of defer her own life in some sense while she was raising them and earning an income. And it just at the moment when they're old enough to fend for themselves, they're 19, and she gets accepted into a PhD program in America and is sort of ready to rush out and, you know, have that life back. And her brother makes a decision which impacts everyone. He leaves. We won't really go into the details of how. And her sister, the twin, is left behind bereft and angry, but also saying to Isma, you have to go. You have to live your life now. And Isma doesn't know, is she doing that because she really believes it or because she's just so wounded that she in some way just wants to sit alone with her wounds.
And so, as you say, Isma is heading off to study in America, But she knows she's under scrutiny, that she'll be questioned and examined every inch of the way. You mentioned recent citizenship, British citizenship. So that scrutiny, is that something familiar that you wanted to write your way into?
Isma has, she has both the specific and the general reasons to be concerned about this. And specifically, there's something in her family history that gives her reason to think that the surveillance state will particularly keeping its eye on her. But generally, it is also a feature of being Muslim in the world, that you, as you're passing through these borders and interrogation points, there is a part of you that is always wondering if someone's going to pull you aside. And I've never had an experience like that at Heathrow. There were a number of years when every time I entered America, I'd go into a secondary examination room and nothing terrible ever happened. I was never asked the kind of ridiculous and intrusive questions that she's asked. But as you sit there waiting to be called up and you're looking around the room and you're noticing the particular, let's say, ethnicity and demographic of the other people in the room, your mind starts imagining the kinds of questions you might be asked and the kinds of answers you'd have to give. And that certainly was something I drew on for Isma.
With this great sense of absurdity of having to think about the cultural significance of the Great British Bake Off.
Well, it's absurd, but part of the reason I put it in there, because I was reading an account once of a British Muslim man who was interrogated again at Heathrow, his own country. He's not committed any crimes, but he went through this massive interrogation. And one thing the man really wanted to know was, you know, how British are you, you British person? And one of the questions he asked was, do you watch Dad's Army? Which, of course, is a show that, you know, I've never watched. Many of us have never watched. And when the man said, no, I don't watch Dad's Army, it was, you know, somehow this was the wrong answer. And perhaps you weren't British enough because you weren't watching some quintessentially British show.
And as Isma's rather arch younger sister, Anika, says, she'd also be better careful that she's not found guilty of GWM, Googling while Muslim.
Yes, that, of course, was a concern as I was researching the novel, which does, you know, it touches on and looks into things such as radicalization and recruitment for Islamic State. And as I was writing that, there was one part of my brain that was saying, you know, if I look up too many websites around this, is it going to send up a flag somewhere? And what will I say if people come knocking on my door saying, and why are you interested in these matters?
Well, your novel takes us into different perspectives on the story, but you do begin with Isma. And so as a reader, I really wanted to stay with her. I wasn't ready to leave her ambitions and longings behind as they're displaced by this younger sister, Anika. Are we supposed to understand Isma as less vivid, less ambitious, ground down by her responsibilities?
I don't think she's less ambitious. I think she has actually a much clearer sense of her ambition, which is she knows what she wants in life to feel content, which, you know, and she's going to get it, which is she wants to be an academic. She wants quiet. She wants to leave behind the sort of messiness of her familial heritage without actually leaving behind the bonds to her sister. But for her, being in this PhD program, fully funded, you can live in this beautiful place and have the time to yourself, that is a great ambition, and she's on her way to get it. Certainly she's ground down by life, but she's also, you know, at the moment we see her, she's thinking actually there, it's not all over. This is just the beginning of things. There are all these possibilities. So I think partly we have to understand her as someone who sets off thinking, you know, now, you know, I've paid my dues and now I can live for myself.
Well, there's Anika and she's young and fierce and bold. Is she fearless, do you think?
No, I think she's full of fears. I think she's largely guided by fears. And I think the fears might make her reckless because there's that desperation to overcome fears. But no, I don't think she's in any way fearless.
And so these two sisters shape the book, but they're having to respond to what the men in their family have done and what the world sees in these men. How much do you think we can say, or do you feel happy saying when you talk about this novel, about what's going on with her twin Parvez?
Well, what I will say is their father, who they didn't know, and Isma knew him briefly, the twins didn't know him at all. We find out quite early on that he was a jihadi, and he died on his way to Guantanamo. And that's sort of the shadow they've been living under, and they respond in different ways to the shadow. And Pervez very much feels himself a fatherless boy and is sort of caught up in the idea of trying to figure out who his father was and how to be a son to that man in ways that his sisters aren't, and that leads him in directions that they would never go into, but they have to live with the consequences of what he's doing.
But throughout the whole book, you're playing with names, aren't you? Names and language are codes and references back to Antigone.
Yes, and so Aemon, you know, it works very well because it is able to give both sides of his family, but it's also a play on Haemon, which is the name of the king's son in the original Antigone play. And so Isma is a play on Ismene. So there is, because it did sort of start with the idea of Antigone, and there were two ways of going about it. One is to sort of, you know, really not acknowledge that I'm using Antigone, and the other one is to just come out from the start and in the name say, yes, you know, Antigone is deep within the novel. The novel is also going to go away from it. So this is not Isma, this is Ismene. It's someone else, but it's connected to that original.
But just sticking with that question of language as well. Mm-hmm. So Isma meets Aemon, this spunky young man, first studying in America. And as they get to know each other, they share bits of Urdu. Now, she knows more than he does. Mm-hmm. But what does the phrase Bey Takalufi mean?
So Bey Takalufi turns out to be one of the few Urdu words he knows, and which sort of surprises her because it means it's one of the few Urdu words his father has taught him. Bey Takalufi is informality or a lack of familiarity, but it's sort of culturally coded to mean it's the kind of lack of formality you have with people who are very close to you. They're almost like family, so that it's almost an insult to them if you're very formal, because there is that understanding that they are close enough to you that you don't have to, you know, abide by certain sort of very polite rules as though they were strangers.
And so this informality as intimacy, now that means an awful lot to her, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, she's, you know, she did want to come to America and get away from her world, but she, once she's there, she misses it, and she's quite an isolated figure. There's one, you know, former professor who she's very close to, who's a Kashmiri woman who she knew when she was in London. But largely, she's quite isolated because there are all these things in her life she can't talk about. But also, you know, she's quite reserved and quite English in many ways. And he comes along and he's familiar, you know, just in the way he looks, in his cultural reference points. He's a fellow Londoner. His father's family used to live in the same neighborhood as her. And so it means a great deal to her that now there's someone who she can talk to. But also in this case, he's an attractive young man. He's from a very different kind of background to her. You know, he's from a much more privileged background, but he still seems to want to be with her. And she's someone who's so self-effacing that if someone who is this attractive and this polished and this charming wants to be with you, it is a surprise to her and a sort of wonder.
And the quote you use at the beginning of the book, the quote from Antigone, is from Seamus Heaney's translation. And the quote is, "The ones we love are enemies of the state," making it so clearly a story for our times.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at different translations, all the translations are picking up on different things and giving you things that echo the contemporary world in different ways. But there is one point in the Heaney translation, which is called The Burial at Thebes, where you actually have the King Creon use the phrase, "You're either with us or against us." I mean, it's very much, you know, he's very much echoing a sort of war on terror, George Bush kind of world. And I've sort of moved it up a few years, I hope, in the kind of echoes and resonances that I'm finding in there. But it is that idea that you know, the state is going to decree certain people its enemies, and that really the people who we think of least are the ones in between, the ones whose line that is, the ones we love are enemies of the state. So I'm not an enemy of the state, but my brother is, or my father is, and I've loved him all my life. Now what do I do? As a citizen of the state, as a sister, as a human being.
Now that you've done this, taken an ancient story and used it as the bones of a novel, is it something you would do again?
I think you never want to be the writer who falls into doing the same things over and over. So, you know, it was a very pleasurable experience. And certainly, it's not that this is the first time I've ever thought of doing it. Particularly because, you know, Shakespeare is one of the great loves of my life, and Shakespeare is so adaptable. So there are always points when, you know, I might look at something and think, oh, you could adapt, you know, Measure for Measure to that or King Lear to that. But I suspect now I've done it once, that means that I can't do it again, at least not for a very long time.
Because the other thing that I think about your writing is that you use history very carefully. So I'm also guessing that you're not going to take that easy line that there's an ahistorical universality to stories, that they transcend history and place.
No, of course, nothing transcends history and place. But what you see when you go back to the Greeks, and you know, it should be said that we are going back to the Greeks more and more these days. There are more Greek tragedies, it feels, being rewritten or adapted or put on stage now than I've known for a very long time. When you go back to the Greeks, you realize that human nature itself and the relationships of power don't change, but the ways in which those play out do. Whether it's the Greeks or whether it's Shakespeare or whoever it is, the reason they still work is that they're still believable about human nature. But the sort of world you put that in and the situations you adapt it around, of course, do change and are flexible, and there will be moments when one play will speak to us much more than the other. I mean, one the interesting things around Antigone is, you know, this is a girl who defies the will of the state in order to bury her brother. That's her basic story. And she's read either as a fanatic who will not recognize any limits, or as a hero who recognizes that there is justice and that sometimes that means you take on the law. And most often this view of hers as a hero will come about in places that are or have suffered oppressive rule. Whereas the view of her as a fanatic is much more likely to come in more liberal democracies where people think that, you know, basically if there's a law, then you're supposed to abide by it.
So, Kamala, you've been longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. You know, when I was growing up in Karachi, we didn't have, you know, you didn't have internet access, you obviously, but you didn't also have a lot of good bookstores that were stocking, you know, English language literary fiction. You do now, but then it was much harder to come by. But my mother always kept an eye on what was up for the Booker and made sure she got hold of those books, whether it was, you know, ordering them from somewhere or having friends visiting from other countries bring them in or whatever it was. So I grew up very much with this idea that, you know, what I knew of contemporary British and Commonwealth and world writing was in some ways being mediated by the Booker judges and the books that they were picking. So it's always, you know, had quite a powerful place in my life as a result. In my case, the novel wasn't yet out when the Booker longlist was announced, and it is about the best entry into the world you can ask for a book of yours.
It certainly is. Yeah. Well, Kamala Shamsi, I galloped through this wrenching story of yours as if it was a thriller, and at the same time, it made me pull up sharply, and I've been thinking about it ever since, so thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Homefire by Kamala Shamsi is published by Bloomsbury. You might have heard Kamala talking on RN recently about what reading meant to her as a girl growing up in Pakistan and now as a reviewer of cricketing books. And she sees a careful poetry in both the sport and in reading itself. But this is the end of our hour of reading. Next week, it's hard to say. There are so many new books coming out. Possibly Con Artists and Bad Behaviour, I think. Join me to be surprised. I'm Kate Evans. This is Books Plus on RN, on ABC Listen, on your bookshelf of podcasts. Next time.